we want every student to see themselves as capable math learners, we have to think critically about the way we teach, the tasks we choose, and the messages we send, both unspoken and spoken. I recently had a chance to talk to Dr. Pamela Seda, who is a leader in math education and co-author of Choosing to See: A Framework for Equity in the Math Classroom. She is committed to changing how students experience math so that all students develop into mathematical thinkers and problem solvers. We had a very actionable and down-to-earth discussion about what equity in math really is and how small shifts in our practice can help all students get what they need in math. We also talked about empowering students to take control of their learning and how to modify tasks in a way that helps every student see math as a tool for creating change. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation with Dr. Pamela Seda. Pam Seda, welcome to the podcast. I am so glad that you are here today.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yes, it was so fun. I got to meet you. Was it the NCTM conference? Was that the first time I actually met you? And then we saw each other at CMC South. So it has been fun to get to run into you. And in preparation for this podcast, I've been listening to a bunch of other podcasts that you've been on and articles that you've written. And one of the things that I heard you say that I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to ask her to explain this more, is I heard you say that math has an image problem. Can you tell me what you meant by that?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that I always get when I tell people I'm a math educator, they always look at me and say, oh, I was terrible at math. And I think a lot of it just has to do with what we see in the media as far as who's good at math. And so generally when you say somebody who's good at math, you think of like a Steve Urkel, someone who's socially inept, who has a pocket protector, who's not cool. If you look at the movies, I remember Mean Girls and the main character was on the math team and she was kept that quiet and she tried to act like she was dumb in class because you can't possibly be popular or attractive and be good at math. And that is just so far from the truth, but that's an image that's constantly portrayed in the media. And the consequences for that to our students is they're like, well, I want to be cool. I want to be popular. And so therefore, I'm not going to put the time and energy and effort into getting good at math because I don't identify with that image of somebody who's good at math.
Yeah. Yeah. You're so right about that. And you know, you've dedicated a lot of your career and the work that you do towards equity in math and making sure that, that every single child experiences math in an equitable way. And I think sometimes we talk about equity in math and it can feel really like high in the sky or theoretical as you described it. And so my goal for our conversation today is I want this to really be the most actionable and just like down to earth discussion around what equity in math education looks like. And I think in order for us to really dive into some of the questions I have for you today, I would love for us to just start by, can you just paint a picture for us of what equitable math instruction looks like? Like just if we were to be able to snap our fingers and have equitable math instruction happening in every classroom around the country or the world, what would that look like?
So firstly, I'm going to start with just equity in general. And I would have never thought that in 2025, equity would be considered a bad word in a lot of circles. And that's because there are people who have willfully chosen to misrepresent equity. So when I talk, I say, this is what I mean by equity. So people can't misrepresent what I'm saying. Yeah. And so for me, equity is simply everyone gets what they need to be successful. As simple as that. Everyone gets what they need to be successful. Now, any of you who've had kids, parents, been a part of a family know that everybody doesn't need the same thing. So part of that is taking time to figure out what do your students need and making sure that they get that and understanding that it's not going to be the same for everyone. So that's equity in general. So then what does equity in mathematics look like? My simple answer is ICU care. It's the seven principles of the ICU care framework. I include others as experts. B, be critically conscious. U, understand your students well. C, use culturally relevant curricula. A, assess, activate, build on prior knowledge. R, release control. And E, expect more. And these are seven principles that kind of help frame the work that we do because we can't really know what a person needs until we interact with them, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, we have some knowledge. Yes, we have a knowledge base. Yes, we have our college degrees, but we really won't know how to put all those things together in the day-to-day decisions that we make unless we understand our students, unless we study right. them, unless we get feedback from them. So these principles kind of help us pull it all together and think about, how do I implement the curriculum? How do I get the content to reach my students in ways that are equitable?
Yeah. And I love this framework. It's so powerful. And we're actually going to zoom in on several different parts of the framework today. But I want to go back to what you initially said about equity, and it's everybody getting what they need. And I think that we can hear that, and sometimes it feels a little overwhelming when you're like, oh my goodness, I've got 30 plus students sitting in the classroom in front of me. How can I possibly give every student what they need? Do you have any ideas for a teacher who's feeling that overwhelm? Like, what would you suggest to them to help them move towards equity in math?
Well, the first thing I realized is, as a teacher, as an individual classroom teacher, I don't have to be the one person to give everybody what they need. As a mother with four children, I very early recognized I can't do it all.
Yes. I've got two and I've already recognized that.
Right. And so what I did is taking that idea as a classroom teacher is what I did is I created structures and routines in my classroom so that I was clear what the expectations were and so that they would learn how to support each other. And so the first principle, include others as experts, meant that I had to shift my thinking from trying to meet the individual needs of 30 kids to me creating a community of learners so that every student is not only responsible for their own learning, but they're also responsible for contributing to the learning of others. And so I am a part, I'm a very integral part of that community of learners, but I'm not the only person that kids can learn from. They can learn from each other. They can find out things on their own. And I see my job, instead of taking knowledge out of my head and putting it in their head, my job is empowering them to be learners.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So that is so good. So I just want to kind of like reiterate what you said and feel free to correct me. So equity is everybody getting what they need. And that does not mean that everybody getting what they need has to be from the teacher. The teacher's role is to really set up a classroom community where everybody can get what they need from each other and the teacher as well.
Absolutely.
Is that, oh my goodness, I love that. And I think that's so powerful. It takes so much pressure. It takes pressure off the teacher to some extent, but also I think allows us as educators to get really focused on what our role is. And it is creating that that community and that culture in the classroom to where everybody is accountable for everybody's learning. And I heard you say that you had some structures and routines in place. Do you mind sharing just a couple of those so teachers can go and implement those in their classroom as well?
Yeah. So, you know, it was little small things, something as simple as, you know, how do you get assignments? And I know when students are absent, they used to always come to me and like, what did I miss? And so one of the things I created were structures where I have to do my lesson plans. I used to do my lesson plans on Friday for the following week. So I knew what the daily assignments were. So why was I hogging that up? So on Mondays, I shared the assignments with my students and I actually gave them an assignment sheet and they wrote all their assignments Monday through Friday on their little assignment sheet. And then I also made it available electronically to parents so that at any moment in time, if they want to know what their kids' assignments were, they could see, my students could see. And so that was just kind of like a simple way so that students would know. Also, when I created lessons, I did PowerPoint slides at the time. And then I always uploaded those to the learning platform. So my students always knew, when they were out, when they came back the next day, they could have their assignment with them because they could watch the lesson. They could, you know, email. I also told them to make sure that they have a buddy in class. And I remember I learned that in college. I always had one person that was a buddy in class so that I could always call and ask questions. So they learned those kind of things. Another really practical thing was I used to have to teach students how to ask for help. Because sometimes they would be so lost and they would just raise their hand and they were like, I didn't get any of it. So right, one of the things I had to teach them how to ask for help was like, okay, go back to the last thing you did understand. So that means they have to think about, okay, where did I fall off the wagon? Where did I get lost? What's the last thing you did understand? I said, and then ask a specific question about the next step. Like,
yeah,
how did you know to add two to both sides? Or how did you know to do this? Like, ask a specific question. And then that way I can know what you last understood, and then I can help you with the next step rather than trying to go back and reteach everything. Another example was how I would have board buddies. So when I did do cold calling, because I wanted every student to understand that everyone is accountable for learning, I wouldn't allow any student to hide in my class. But if for some reason you felt uncomfortable or you didn't know the answer, you could pick anyone in the classroom to help you. And they could go up to the board with you and show you and help you do it, but you were still responsible for answering the question.
Right.
So those are just some examples.
Yeah. Well, and I think going back to the one that you said about ask or teaching students how to ask for help, that is a life skill. Like, we have to know how to communicate our needs. And when we are in a situation where we need help, we've got to be able to ask very targeted questions. And even I think with like the rate or the rise of AI, AI is only as powerful as the questions you ask it, right?
Absolutely.
So I love that. I love, you know, as you teach your students how to ask for help, it allows them to better communicate their needs with other students, because we as teachers, I think maybe can do a better job of asking good questions to figure out what they need help with, but other students may not have that skill yet. And so that's such a powerful thing for you to be teaching students specifically how to ask for help.
I came to that conclusion because I realized a lot of my students weren't asking for help. And because I had oftentimes fell into deficit thinking, I would always blame the kids. Well, they're not asking for help. Then, you know, that's on them. But then I realized because of this image, right, that we have of what you are, if you're good in math, many people, that image is, well, smart people don't ask for help. Mm-hmm. And so there's this insecurity and this fear. And then the other thing is, as I've been in those situations, sometimes you're so lost, you don't even know where or how to ask for help. So I realized that's on me to teach them how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned kind of like your perception of students who didn't ask for help. And this reminded me of I think it's the first C in your framework about being, what is it, critically conscious?
Conscious, yes.
I would love to just zoom in on that real quick. What does being critically conscious mean? And can you just tell us a little bit more of that step in the framework?
Certainly. So I used to think that my students' identities didn't really impact learning. I didn't think that culture had anything to do with math. I thought math was a culture neutral subject. Until I started teaching and I realized, like a lot of across the nation, it was often happening in my classroom, in my school, students with disabilities, Black students, ELL students, Hispanic students were always at the bottom of the math achievement. If that was so persistent and consistent, I had to start really looking at, well, why? Why is that case? Is that the case? Right. And one of the things I realized is that we make a lot of assumptions about students based on stereotypes. And those stereotypes exist in the world, whether we believe them or not, they're there. And our students are impacted by those stereotypes. And if I want my students to be able to overcome those stereotypes, I can't afford to bury my head in the sand and pretend like the stereotypes don't exist. Mainly because if I bury my head in the sand, I can't recognize how those stereotypes impact me. And how mm-hmm. I have fallen into making assumptions about students. So when a student doesn't ask a question and they may happen to be Black, I can assume, well, that's why they're not performing, is because they won't ask for help. If they only asked for help, they would be performing better. And I would constantly oftentimes get into that thought pattern is that it's something wrong with the kids. It's something wrong with them. And not realizing that I have a role and a responsibility. And even though there are certain things about learning that I can't control, I can always influence. I can influence everything that's going on in my classroom with my presence and understanding that power in the relationships that I have with kids. Even when they've been absent, I might not be able to control whether a kid's absent or not and what's going on at home to why they may be absent. But I absolutely can control the environment I create for that student when they do come to my classroom. Do I make them feel welcome? Do I let them know that they're missed? Do I have this environment so that it creates hope that when they do come, that they are valued and that they have something to contribute to the class environment? I absolutely can influence those things. And so that critical consciousness is taking the time to understand how stereotypes impact your students, being aware, and then actively choosing to empower your students to overcome that. And just not think that if you just teach the math in whatever way you want to, that automatically your students from marginalized groups needs are going to get met. It's just not going to happen. You have to consciously empower your students to overcome those stereotypes.
Yeah. So I think there's like two parts to what you're saying. One, we need to reflect on like our own biases and how we contribute to the teaching and learning process, how our own biases contribute to that. And then also reflect on and acknowledge the stereotypes that are present for our students and how that impacts their experience learning. Is that correct? There's kind of like two sides to this.
Absolutely. So, and I know that traditionally in my work around this, most of the time we stop at my biases, but it's not really about us. My whole framework is about kids. And if we spend so much time just looking at our own bias and not recognize that our students have agency, right? And then help them overcome those biases, then I think we end up spinning our wheels too long, I think sometimes.
I really want to dive into these two aspects because I feel like the first one, reflecting on our own biases, I feel like that is where a lot of people, this is not even really just a teacher discussion. I mean, just people in general get a lot of, I think maybe put their guard up and get really defensive.
Right.
When we all have biases.
Yes.
Like every single one of us.
Yes.
And I think that, so you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
And so with that, I think when we can just all come to accept that like having biases does not make us a bad person. It is maybe like what our actions are as a result of those biases, or just the willingness to sit and reflect on the biases that we have and how it is contributing to our teaching. Like it is okay to say, I have biases. Let me sit in this and work through and figure out if certain things that I am doing are helping or hurting students in the learning process. Like, would you agree with that? That is a accurate.
So, you know, oftentimes this is where equity opponents sometimes attack because they'll say that we're trying to make white people feel guilty for being white. And one of the things that I had to recognize was as a Black person who was teaching Black students, I still held on to made a lot of assumptions about students based on stereotypes because I'm just as much of a victim of the stereotypes because I live in this world.
Yes.
And so this is not about my own racial identity. It's not about skin color. It's about me willing to learn from my students and pay attention to the impact that I am having on my students. And just thinking about, okay, why am I assuming this? Where is this assumption coming from? What evidence do I have that these assumptions I'm making are true? And when I start looking at the evidence and then realizing I have influence then it just changes everything. Mm-hmm. But I think, like I said, it's not enough to stay there. That's just the first step, but right. It's also paying attention to the interactions and what's happening in your classroom. So like before I heard about Peter Liljedahl's work, I would form groups, and I know that I had to pay attention because oftentimes the girls in the groups would just be overtalked and their ideas would not be listened to because the boys would just overtalk them. And so I had to make a conscious decision that when I'm putting groups together, and for some reason I might only have one girl to be able to be in a group, that might just have worked out that way. So I was very conscious about the kind of the girl that I would be put in that group. I'm like, okay, she can handle herself because she's not going to allow herself to be talked over or talked down. And it's things like that, that if I wasn't conscious of those things, then it would impact the learning of my students in a negative way because I just wasn't paying attention. And we can't afford not to pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, I think to add to that, assumptions about students are not just exclusive to assumptions because of their race or their gender. I think even about the students who have, I don't know what they're called where you're at, but here in North Carolina, they're called EOGs. That's their standardized test. And, you know, they get a 1 through a 5. And I think even about the students who have for years seen a 1 on the EOG, they hold certain beliefs about their own abilities, and yes. We may hold certain beliefs about their abilities, yes. And we have to be aware of how those beliefs are impacting how the student shows up in the class, and also how we support or over-support them because we are lowering our expectations because we see a 1, you know, 3 years in a row on their end of grade tests. So this being critically conscious, I feel like, is about so many ways. So many areas that are assumptions and students' assumptions about themselves impact this teaching and learning process.
Absolutely. I tell the story in the book about how I was an instructional coach at a school, and the students there, it was like an alternative school. So these kids were not successful in the regular environment. So obviously it's very easy to have low expectations for them because they haven't been successful in their regular school.
Right.
And I remember the teacher was getting ready to do a lesson on graphing. And I asked the teacher, well, can we use graphing calculators? I want to do an activity with them with graphing calculators. And they were like, no, I need them to graph by hand first. And once they get that, then I'll let them use the graphing calculator. I was like, let me just teach the lesson. And so they were like, okay. And the graphing calculators had been in the file cabinet. They were still in the plastic. No one had used them. And so I came to them and I was like, hey, y'all, we've got these new calculators. Can y'all help me figure out how to use them? They're like, sure. So to begin with, how often do teachers ask students to help them? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's this part of us as human beings that builds our self-esteem when people ask us for help. Because that shows that we have value, and everyone mm-hmm. wants to feel valued in that way. So I remember asking them, and then we ended up doing an activity, and it was an inquiry-based activity where they were trying to figure out how much, I think it was something about crate and some oranges, and they had to write a linear equation and eventually figure out that the weight of the crate was the y-intercept and the weight of each orange was the slope. And they figured all of that out. Because it was given in a context. And I remember the teacher was just really surprised. He was like, wow, I was really shocked that they were able to do so much. And that's because we oftentimes don't give them the opportunity to rise, to do the problem solving, to do the critical thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that kind of hits at that. Is it the last letter in the framework, the expect more?
Yes.
I think the other C is culturally relevant tasks. Is that right?
Use culturally relevant curricula. Yes.
Oh, yes. There we go. And I heard you talk in another podcast about kind of like stages for modifying tasks to make them more culturally relevant.
Yes.
Can you kind of walk us through those stages? Because I was just I thought it was so brilliant.
Thank you. So just like we know our ultimate goal is we want to get kids to higher level math in 12th grade, but we don't start them in kindergarten with calculus, right? And oftentimes we forget that as teachers who are learning how to engage in culturally relevant work, this is a new expectation. Sometimes we just think that, oh, I'm just supposed to be able to engage in this social justice task where kids are automatically empowered. And we forget that as teachers, we're learners as well. So I created a continuum, what I call a continuum of culturally relevant tasks. And so a stage one task is we have to start off with a cognitively demanding task. Because if it's not cognitively demanding, it's not worth adapting.
And can I stop you right there? So that is something that, like, I don't even think I heard the term cognitively demanding task until I was getting my master's. And so I just want to be really aware of the fact that we may have some newer teachers who are watching or just teachers who haven't been engaged in these conversations. Can you describe what you mean by a cognitively demanding task?
Yeah. So I just make it simple. Do students have to engage in the standards for mathematical practice to be able to do this problem? Do they have to make sense? Do they have to persevere? Do they have to construct viable arguments? Do they have to look for structure? It's like out of those eight mathematical practices, are kids engaging or do they have to engage in any of those practices to be able to do the problem? Because if they already know how to do the problem and that can just rotely do it, they don't have to make sense of it. They just do it. Then it's an exercise. It's not a problem. Yeah. And I'm not saying there's not a place for exercises. Really, exercises are important to keep and retain skills over a period of time. So you are going to need to go back and revisit old things that are exercises. But when kids are learning things, it needs to be cognitively demanding, which means students need to engage in the standards for mathematical practice to be able to do them. So
wonderful.
I believe that all textbooks have some cognitively demanding tasks. You may have to look for them, or it may be a stage zero task that you may have to modify. And so this is just like one way to do it. One of the things that I've done is you might have a question. You might ask students to explain, you know, if they have an answer, explain why, justify your reasoning is something that can add to it. Another way to ramp up what I call the rigor is give students an answer and have them create the problem. So normally, instead of asking what 3 + 2 is and you expect them to give you 5, say create 2 problems or 3 problems or how many ever problems you can with the sum is 5.
Yeah.
And so then now it's going backwards. And so that ramps up the rigor. So sometimes you may have to ramp up the rigor and for a problem to make it cognitively demanding. But the thing that's real important is that it's not worth making culturally relevant if it's not at least stage one cognitively
right.
demanding
not,
task.
Yes.
So that's where we start. And I believe that if we gave all of our students cognitively demanding tasks and start there, that would do a great amount of good just to decrease the achievement gap. Because we know a lot of our students, just due to low expectations, aren't even getting access to cognitively demanding tasks.
Because we may not believe that they can that they can access it. We may not believe that they can do it. And so we avoid giving them these tasks, which is why, going back to what we said, it's so important for us to be critically conscious and recognize that, like, we may have assumptions, we act by not giving them those cognitively demanding tasks. And then it's kind of becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because they've never had the opportunity to experience them. So,
and even thinking about what it means to be a teacher, going back to the first conversation, we were talking about include others as experts. If I see my role is to make sure I tell you what to do so you get to the right answer, if that's how I see my role as a math teacher, then yeah, you're going to say, well, they can't do it because they don't know how to do it. But if you believe that your role is to create the conditions and the learning environment in class so that students are empowered,
yeah,
that they can figure things out, if you believe that creating a collaborative environment so that students can figure out the math, then it's a different mindset. Because this is how I think. yeah, my students can't do this now, but that's why I'm here. Right. If the kids already knew how to do it, then what do they need me for? They don't need a teacher.
Right.
If the kids already know how to do it. So when I hear teachers say, my kids can't do that, okay, you're right. If they could already do that, then they would. You wouldn't need to teach them. Right.
Right.
The point is they can't do this. So you're going to create the learning environments and create those supportive structures so that they can figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
And they can.
Absolutely.
Over time.
Absolutely.
And what I oftentimes hear, though, when I hear teachers say my kids can't, what I really hear is I, as a teacher, don't know how to facilitate that environment.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Is you're willing to ask and get help, just like we want our kids to ask for help. We have to make it safe for teachers to ask for help.
Yeah.
And be willing to acknowledge and say, you know what? I really don't know how to create that environment so my kids can figure that out. Let's create that safe space.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that so much. That reframe of my kids can't do this to I don't know how to create the environment to support them finding success in this. So that's wonderful. Okay. I totally got us off track. So we start with a cognitively demanding task. That is like
we got
the beginning. Okay.
Cognitively demanding. Okay. So a baby step is to take that task and replace the names in it with names of your students, names that are meaningful to your students. So it could be your students' names. It could be the school's name. It could be streets that are in their communities, stores, events that are that your students are familiar with. Replace the names with ones that are meaningful. So sometimes it could just be even inserting a name, because there might not be a name at all. It might just be generic and just inserting a student's name. But I do want to give a little caution here. And I want to say that this is not putting stereotypical names in there. If you don't have a student named Pablo in your class, don't put Pablo in the problem. We want your students' names or names that are meaningful to your students there. Yeah. So that's step two. It's a baby step, but that's a good place to start. Mm-hmm. And then once you're comfortable doing that, then you can go to the next step and replace the context with ones that are meaningful to your students. And so it just might mean instead of a generic bat and ball problem where your kids don't care about baseball, it might be replacing it with a soccer context, or replacing it with a context based on a student survey that you did at the beginning of the year to get to know your students. And you've replaced that context with something that your kids. I remember doing that survey and one of my students was interested in astronomy, so that I could create an astronomy context for that problem. And then once you're comfortable replacing the context, now mind you, the math stays the same. We're not changing numbers, because every time I started changing numbers, the math came out funky and I was just like, I'm not that good to start trying to change the numbers of the math problems. So it's leaving the math the same, changing the context. And then eventually we want to get to a stage four task where your students are empowered to be agents of change and thinking about how they can use math as a tool now. Like, math is a human endeavor. We all use mathematics. When I get ready to leave the house and I have to figure out how early I need to leave the house to get to someplace, I'm using math.
Right.
Right. If I want to figure out if I'm going to the laundromat and I need to know how many quarters to take with me, I'm doing math modeling with mathematics. People use math all the time. If I want to figure out how far I can go before I have to gas up again, I'm using mathematics. And helping our students see that math can be used as a tool to empower them to make their lives better, their communities better, and being a doers of mathematics is that stage four.
So what does that look like in the classroom? Like how do teachers go from the stage three to the stage four? Like what do they need to change in their practice in order to do that?
So there's two ways to do it. There's the easy way and the more difficult way. The easy way is after you found out your interest from your students, go to ChatGPT and give them the problem and say, here, change it to this context. So that students are empowered to change. And I've literally done that. They change this problem so that students are empowered to change, be a agent of change. And I might give them a context based on something that I've learned from my students. That is one way to do it. Another way is just to kind of pay attention and even ask your students, what problems do you face? What challenges? What do you see that's unfair? What issues do you face in our school, in our community? And then think about how you can address that in using math. Yeah. It's just paying attention to your students. So in one presentation, I gave an example of how a teacher noticed that there were lots of fights in the hallway and that their hall had a lot more fights in the hall below them, which is for the gifted students. And this teacher could have fallen into stereotypes about the behavior of gifted students versus the behavior of general ed students. And just thought it was, you know, based on the quality of the student. But they decided to use this as an opportunity for students to be able to be empowered to be agents of change. So she was thinking it might have something to do with the number of students in the hallway.
Mm.
So she had them compute the number of students per square foot for both hallways, noticing that there were much fewer students in the gifted hallway. She asked her students to pull the data together and present it to their board. And their school board was so impressed with their presentation that they made adjustments and reduced the number of students on the general hallway, and the number of fights really was rapidly decreased. And so that was an example of students being able to see math really is a tool, and that I really do have power in my life to make a change. And I can use math to do that.
I absolutely love that. That is so cool. And I think that this gets at, I think for us as educators, is really having this like lens to look for situations like this. Like, it's not enough to just say, okay, this is the standard, we're going to teach the standard, but really get curious and think about how we can use math and apply math in these really meaningful ways to students, and also encourage our students to have this lens and for them to be curious. Because, you know, now hearing this story, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's brilliant. And as soon as you kind of started it, I was like, I know where she's going with this. But I don't think we always have that lens where we're looking for just that like real world example of how math can really help us advocate for something better or change. Or so I really, really love that.
And the other way is there are social justice tasks. There are other books that are already out there. Dr. Shelley Jones and Lou Matthews written one on for elementary and for secondary on culturally relevant tasks. There's the social justice tasks that Corin has. So there are other books where they're already out there where you can try if you want to try somebody else's task. And then once you get comfortable with that, then you'll get more comfortable in seeing those things, right? Seeing what challenges students have and how math can be used as a tool to help them.
Yeah. And I think that this goes back to your framework is brilliant. I mean, you are brilliant, but your framework is also brilliant because everything really connects, because this goes back to another one of the sections in your framework, which is, I don't remember which letter it is, but it's like, know your students.
Understand your students well, you, yes.
Yeah.
And yeah. We were talking about the image problem, right? If people don't want to identify with mathematics, this is you helping recreate that image, because now they're seeing math as a tool that I can use to improve my life, improve the lives of my community, improve the lives of our... So this is something that I can get behind and identify with.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, my hope is that in even just the short discussion we've had, that we can stop like fearing the word equity and or feeling any type of like shame or judgment around this word, and instead just really dive into this work. Because I just like the more that, you know, I consume things about equity and math, and the more that I learn from you, this is such important work that I truly don't understand how anybody could not get behind. Like, if you, your definition of equity being like everybody gets what they need, like, I don't understand why there would be any argument about that, but I just think there's so much, just lack of understanding of what this work is. And so I just really appreciate you and what you were doing and just the compassion you have and the things that you were saying. And just, very practical things that you share. I think it really helps all of us take steps forward in making math more equitable for every student.
Well, thank you. That was my goal. That was my goal for writing the book.
Tell us more about the book.
Certainly.
Your work in general.
Choosing to See a Framework for Equity in the Math Classroom. I co-authored it with Dr. Kendall Brown, who is the executive director of the California Mathematics Project at UCLA. And it is based on the ICU CARE framework, which came out of my doctoral work while I was at Georgia State. And my goal for writing the book was kind of exactly what you were saying, is I wanted to take it out of just the theoretical, and I wanted teachers to be able to say, I can do this. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I can do this. I gave them not only the theory about how to think about it, but gave a lot of concrete examples of specific things that they can do. And I really do believe this was a privilege that I, even though I graduated, got my doctorate degree in 2007, I went back to the classroom and taught and went back to K-12 and was a math supervisor. But even after being a math supervisor and instructional coach, I went back to the classroom to really try these things out and try them on students. And I'm by no means saying I'm the end all and have it all together. I just know that I was constantly learning from my students and they responded.
Yeah.
And that to me was proof that this does work. It's kids respond to when they know that you are trying to give them what they need to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I know after this discussion, and of course, run, get her book. But I know after this discussion, our teachers will want to connect with you. So where is the best place for them to go if they want to connect with you?
Yes, the best way is to go to my website, PamSeda.com, PamSeda.com is the best way to get in touch with me. And then when they get there, they can subscribe to my newsletter. So I do have a weekly newsletter, and there's a store where they can purchase my book, as well as I have a math card game that implements the release control principle. I have an online course for teachers as well as leaders. So my website is a good place to start, PamSeda.com.
I was going to say, sounds like you stay busy creating all of the things. Well, awesome. Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with me. And I cannot wait for us to talk math again soon.
Well, thank you. This was a delight.